Okay. This is Roger Eardley Pryor at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Today is July 14th, it's a Friday in 2017, and we are conducting an oral history, oral future interview with Hune Saberi, Dr. Hune Saberi. So to get started, would you mind spelling your name for us?
I spell it P-O-U-N-E, and then there's an accent that goes on the E, so the Pune, and then my last name, S-A-B-E-R-I.
Great. And where were you born?
I was born in Tehran, Iran.
Fantastic. When were you born?
When? Mm-hmm. I have to tell you the year.
You don't have to. You can decide what you want to say and what you don't.
So I was born during the time of the Shah, and my childhood was during the revolution.
Wow. So can you tell me about what your family, mother and father, what were they doing in Iran around then?
My mother was a teacher. She taught Persian literature. Hmm. My father worked for the Central Bank of Iran.
What were their names?
Shireen is my mother's name, and my dad's name was Masoud.
Masoud. Beautiful. And what kind of work they were doing there when you arrived again? Your mother was teaching literature?
That was her job.
Mm-hmm. And your father, again?
He was an accountant, he worked for the Central Bank.
Oh, right on.
Yeah.
Very cool. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister, and she does research on HIV.
Wow.
And she lives in San Francisco right now.
She's also a doctor.
She actually trained in pharmacy. She trained as a pharmacist, but then really, her career took on a different path and started doing research on HIV medications.
Wow. What were some of your early childhood memories?
So as I said, a big part of my childhood is very much intertwined with, this kind of political upheaval and the revolution of 1979. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my memories are around that.
Would you mind sharing some?
What happened was that the year that I started first grade was the year that the revolution happened. And so then starting second grade, we had to go to school. Like first grade, we don't have to cover our hair, but then second grade, we had to cover our hair because, by then, was the Islamic Republic. And then there were a lot of demonstrations and a lot of, chanting and gathering at nights, grown-ups and, kind of guns and...
Do you remember seeing those things?
Seeing what?
Seeing these kind of rallies and these sort of meetings.
There was, my parents participated, they were pretty active, and speaking about things that kind of change your future, this whole idea of this egalitarian, type of sense of we're all equal and, there's no, difference in classes and that type of thing. So then they would go off and I'd stay back with my grandmother, and she was, she wasn't a very kind of a daring person, so she'd stay back and she'd be praying on her rosary beads, and I was little and I'd stay back. So it was a very, there's a lot of, a lot of active discussions and arguments and, political kind of debates and, but also, and then it was also kind of people who I knew who disappeared.
Really?
People who were, political and they were no longer because, know, they were jailed and hung. And
are these kind of things you heard from your parents talk about?
So, yeah, so then I would, like, you know, wonder, well, where are they, you know, but then, like, you kind of would listen in on the grown-up conversations. You know, they think you're not listening, you know, but you're listening. And then you'd know what happened, and you'd be like, yeah, and so it would be, yeah, I mean, it's thinking back, like, as a kid, you don't question things, but thinking back, I'm like, God, that was traumatic.
Yeah. Did you have ideas about if that would happen to you or any of your family members?
Yeah, definitely. So there is, like, a memory of, I have where, so my parents listened to a lot of, like the poets and the writers who were politically active, and they had kind of, like, their cassettes, because that's what we had back then. We had cassettes. That's, like, how old I am. In school, somebody mentions one of the poets, and then I say, oh, we have that. And then I came home, and I was like, Mom, you know, in school, like they said. And then they start, like, giving me this whole lesson about some kid who, like, essentially, like, what the kid ended up saying was, like, ratting the parents out, and then, like, they hauled the parents away. And I was like, oh, my God, like, you know, I'm going to be the cause of my parents, like, you know, disappearing. And so it was very frightening, because you grew afraid of what you said very fast. Hmm. You just had to keep your kind of, like, mouth shut and not say anything.
Did the revolution impact your parents' lives and their career?
Yeah.
In what ways?
They quickly, after the Islamic Republic came, became the law of the land, they realized that this is not what they fought for, and they were super disillusioned. They were really kind of, like, upset and angry about it. And so my dad quit his job. He started his, like, own carpentry shop. He just didn't want to work for the government. My mom kept teaching as well, but they kind of had, like, a sense of, I don't know, I guess, like, you know, significant amount of dismay, you know, just like, this is not what we lost our, you know, people that our friends and, you know, families for. And then it was also a very, kind of a very restrictive time. Like, you couldn't, like, you know, like, let's say we'd go to a, you know, a dinner gathering, and, you know, they'd take me with them. On the way back, the guard would stop the car and search you, you know, so it was like, you know, like if you'd been drinking alcohol or something, you know. So it was also very frightening, like, to kind of move around. There was also a, what is it, curfew, a military curfew. So then, like, you know, you'd be kind of like the sleepy kid in the back, and then, like, you hear, you know, you see the flashlights, and then my mom's best friend, her mother was traveling, coming back. I guess she had used a newspaper. She'd stuffed it in her shoe, and while she was away, that newspaper had become outlawed. So when she came back, this was, like, stuffed in her shoe. She was jailed 2 years for that.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. This is my mother's friend's mother.
Oh, wow.
So my best friend's grandmother.
That's a scary time to be a little girl.
Yeah, right. So again, like, you know, like, at the time, you just kind of go through life, right? Like, what else, what other options do you have as, like, a 7-year-old? But then in retrospect, I'm like, wow. They, you know, really need to pay attention to children, like, during the times of, you know, war and that kind of thing. Because, of course, it didn't let up, right? Then it was the Iran and Iraq war.
Right.
And then, you know, that's when, like, you know, all the air raids and the bombing, and then, like, you know, getting woken up at night, you know, and windows shaking and running down into, you know, like, cellars. And that's when it started. And then after that, my mom was like, all right, we're done, we're leaving. And then so then, and then her sisters had lived in the United States, like, you know, prior to that, but my mom, you know, loves her country, and my grandparents love their country, and my uncle, so they never wanted to leave. But then after, she was like, all right, we're done.
So what happened?
My father, so we essentially got visas and then we came here. And then my parents, and then we got green cards. And then...
Where did you come when you came to the U.S.?
Boston. That's where my family lived. Yeah, they all lived there. I had a couple of aunts and uncles who'd lived there for a long time, 20 years. I guess, yeah, so at that time might have been like 10, 15 years, you know. I mean, they've lived there for, I don't know how long, whatever. It was a long time.
Yeah.
And then we got a green card. But then, like, my parents didn't like it here. They went back.
Oh, they did? When?
They went back in 1989.
Wow. So only a few years.
Yeah. They came here for a few years. They came here for, like, 5 years. And they went back.
What about you and your sister?
So my sister, because she was younger, she had to go back with them. She went back with them. I was last year of high school, entering college, and you know I'd already gotten accepted, so I just went to college and then stayed with my aunts.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
What did you think about when you were a little girl moving to the U.S.? What was life like in Boston for you?
So I was kind of like a tween then. I don't know. I wouldn't say I loved it. I would say that the thing that struck with me was the kind of I have language for it now. I didn't have language for it back then. There's kind of a depth of human interaction that I had experienced like with my friends, you know, this kind of like deep friendship and
your friends back in Iran?
My friends back in Iran. And then, you know, and also like between just humans in general. Like my cousins in Iran and, you know, like my parents and their friends and their neighbors and, you know, their kind of communities. And then to come to the United States, I found everything was watered down. There's like a watered down quality to that. It's kind of like really superficial and, you know, and I think part of that, and it's interesting because like during the Trump, you know, thing, like this whole like, you know, collective trauma, like the at least the blue states, you know, maybe, you know, parts of the red states, you know, people went through. It's kind of like, you know, it's really that I think, you know, really connects people in such a deep way. I'm not saying we need trauma for a deep connection, but I do think it has something to do with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't love it. I didn't love it.
But you decided to stay.
I decided to stay because I hated the, I hated the country it had become. Iran, I didn't hate the country. I just hated the political climate that it had become. I didn't want to cover my hair. I felt like it was like total infringement on my personal rights. And I was also kind of like in general, I would say like a little quirky, like not really, I don't win popularity contests, let's just say it like that, you know? And so, like, I kind of like environments where I'm allowed to just kind of do my own thing, like be my own person. And I felt like, I just felt like it was kind of like a lot more of, you know, kind of a strict. The strictness of it makes it more scripted. I mean, I'm actually wrong about that. I do think that in the United States, there's also a lot of kind of scripted lifestyles.
What do you mean when you say scripted? What does that mean?
Like, it means, like, I guess, you know, the schema that most people associate, the script that most people associate with, you know, is like, you know, house in the suburbs and 2.5 kids, you know, like that type. That's kind of the closest thing I can, you know, kind of come up with. You know, and I'm wrong about Iran. It's not true that it's like, you know, that script is imposed as strictly as I had envisioned, because there's plenty of people who are doing their own thing there now. And a lot of my friends, you know, from there, you know, they're like kind of movie directors, you know, and you know, they're like, you know, playwriters and, you know, actors and, you know, that type of thing. And so, like, I have my best friend, she was accepted as a chemical engineer in college, in the university. She went for 1 year. I was like, this isn't for me. So she enrolled in school of drama, didn't tell her mom, and for the rest of her college career, every day she'd get up, you know, like go as if she's going, but she wasn't going to school of engineering. She was going to, you know, school of drama. So, yeah. So, I mean, she, like, you know, so.
And this was back in Iran.
Yeah.
So you maintain friendships with people there, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
Was that something that you carried with you when you came and Kate stayed in contact, or did those develop later?
No, I stayed in contact, you know, and also, like, I had a lot of cousins, you know, so I have, like, kind of big family, you know, some of that is from there, and then some of it is kind of, like, again, my family's, you know, like, my mother, my mother and father's, like, you know, children who, you know, might have, you know, maintained relationships and friendships with, but also my own school friends. You know, I was in touch with them a lot more back then than I am now, but still... And still in touch with them, see them when I go back.
Was there a strong sense of community in Boston because of the family? For you?
Yeah, you know, mainly for my mom. She's really close to her sisters, and two of her sisters live there. So, like, if you let them, they'd be hanging out together all the time. Like, what'd you guys do today? You know, my mom's visiting and she's like in her sister's house right now in Boston. It's like, what'd you guys do today? Like, they can't even tell me one thing, but, and yet, like, you know, they spend their whole day together, you know. And so there's that sense. But then again, like I said, I don't spend my time like that. Like, I spend my time different. Like, there has to be a purpose to my day, and kind of like, you know, something like a list of things that I have to achieve, and I have my own list. And
where do you think that comes from for you?
I think that part of it is that. I don't know, maybe just there's kind of like a saying that translates to something like time is gold, you know, like that time is has more value than money. And so, you know, also like this kind of like sense of I grapple with the question of how do we leave our mark on the world in general. And it's interesting because, like, my sister also kind of, that's like her existential question too. So I feel like it must have something to do with it, but I don't know how.
Huh. Do you remember feeling a certain way maybe in junior high or high school, like, I really need to get out and do some things? Or did it emerge at a certain time, do you think?
I can't answer that right now. Like, mm-hmm. I'd have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When your parents were in Boston, what kind of work did they find themselves doing here?
That was part of it. Like, their work wasn't really gratifying for them. Like, my mother opened up her own daycare, you know, but, you know, she loves the children, but she was like, you know, was doing like a lot more high level, you know, type of. And then my, you know, dad was working with my uncle for a while, and then he was doing kind of like woodworking for a while, and then he just didn't find it, like, you know, really gratifying either, and that was part of the reason why they went back.
When they went back, did your father start working with the banks again?
No. My father, it's not funny, I'm just laughing because it's like uncomfortable to talk about. My father had a severe stroke, ended up becoming disabled, and then died. That's it's like, yeah, it didn't end that well for him.
And your mother chose to stay, despite her sisters being in Boston.
Yeah, her parents were there, and she's very close to her parents. And then her rest of her family was also there. She's also really close to her brother, and he was also there. And and again, you know, she has, like, it's an interesting thing. So I was listening to this, like, interview, just happened to be listening to this interview on NPR about this other Iranian woman who's an author. And then it was like, when she was talking, I was like, I could have said every single one of those sentences. And she wrote about her, kind of like, the, you know, village that she grew up in, in Iran, and, you know, her dad, and it's like a novel, I think she wrote, I forget the name. What was interesting is that, number one, she used the word a chameleon. She feels like a chameleon. And I was like, that's exactly what I've called myself for, like, you know, the past, whatever, 25 years. And then she said, somebody told her, you either have roots or wings, and you almost don't have, you never can have both. And so she felt like her father had the roots, you know, and she did. And I was like, that's exactly right.
Which do you feel like you have?
The wings, definitely. And I feel like it becomes like a little bit of a point of contention, you know, it's like, well, like, and it's like, the world's my home, you know, it's, you know, like, however this cookie crumbled, this is how it crumbled, you know, and so I don't have that same sense of, like, you know, fierce, like, loyalty, you know, to the land. Like, I have fierce loyalty to Earth, but that is not defined for me by, you know, geopolitical boundaries. So
when you were in high school, what were the kind of classes and things that you were into? Like, what were the things you enjoyed doing then?
So I would say, I was really good at math. That kind of came just really easily to me. So they kind of moved me up, and I ended up in, like, this class with all these, like, you know, people who became physicists, and I wasn't that good. So I don't know. And they was like all these, like, theoretical, you know, like, mathematical, you know, like, hypothesis, you know, theory proving stuff.
That seems like a pretty high end high school.
Yeah, it was a private high school. Yes, it was. It was.
What was the name of the school?
Commonwealth.
In Boston.
In Boston. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also was really good at languages, so I took a lot of, like, you know, French and Italian. You know, and that was really, that was cool. I enjoyed that.
Did you grow up speaking Farsi at home?
Mm-hmm.
Did you keep doing that in Boston?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Language. I could see the languages. You having a space in your brain for that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's kind of part of my kind of skill, like, math and languages, you know, kind of go together, and those two things I'm good at. Let's see, what else? Oh, and but it was the reason, it was kind of an interesting high school, because the thing that they taught you regardless was comparative literature, so I also kind of, like, really became, like, you know, it was good to really learn the English literature, you know.
Do you remember some of the stories that you gravitated toward that you really liked?
In high school?
Sure.
Let me think. It was a lot of poetry. So they did a lot of kind of, like, you know, to, you know, do a lot of kind of poetry, like dissecting and, you know, that type of stuff. There was also a Bible studies class, but it wasn't like a religious class. It was like Bible as a work of
literature.
Yeah. And that was really interesting, because we had to, like, I read the Bible, you know, and I know, like, you know, passages from the Bible, you know, but as just kind of like a piece of literature. Let me think. I don't know. I have to think about that.
Was religion something that was a part of your life growing up?
Yeah, my grandparents were very religious. They both were descendants of theologians. So, yeah. So they, like, I had to learn how to pray. And then, of course, in school, you had to read the Quran, and you had to take Arabic. And
after first grade, at least.
After first grade, exactly. I'm I'm agnostic slash atheist.
I was going to say, when did, if that was part of early life and come to the United States, different kind of context, but still have the Iranian family that's there, when did you make a transition for the role of religion in your life?
I don't know. I never thought about it. I always thought, you know, religion holds people back. I feel like it's like a brain, you know, like it makes people's brains more dense. I have since come to not have that strong a view as I used to. I recognize the... it's the health benefits of religion is actually very fascinating to me. And also, like...
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, like how like people who belong to kind of a larger community, a larger religious community, have less health bad health outcomes. They have like lower rates of, you know, certain things. And part of that has to do with the impact of community on a person, and that religion is providing a reason to be part of. So it's not the religion, it's being part of a community. But that in itself is really interesting. And then there's also the kind of the adding a layer of spirituality that also has kind of health benefits. And also, like, and I think maybe this has come as a result of working with, like, faith-based organizations that work on climate. It's kind of like seeing maybe, you know, where religion can take you that's good. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Because, anyway, my experience is that, like anything that has to do with religion can't be anything good. It's all bad. It could lead to, like, destruction, you know. But I've maybe come to like revise that a little bit. One of my aunts, she's writing a book on the role of prayer in kind of middle class communities in women in Iran, like, and about how this like combination of like culture and literature and poetry and prayer is all part of like this, just their kind of normal life, you know, in a way that's, you know, that's none of, like, they're not actively seeking to be like, you know, literary people or, you know, like religious people. It's just kind of like part of what, you know, they're comfortable with and they like, and it's a common language that they speak in. Anyway, so that's, I don't know, so I'm just using those as kind of examples of mm-hmm. how I'm, like, seeing it differently a little bit now.
Yeah. When you made the transition from high school to college, where did you go, and why did you go there?
I went there because I went to UMass Amherst, mm-hmm. and I went there because I was a Massachusetts resident, and that would be, like, the cheapest, you know, college. I was accepted at Bryn Mawr as well, but that was going to be a lot of money to take out, and I went to UMass Amherst, and
What did you study there? What were you drawn to?
Yeah, so I had these, like, you know, kind of notions that I could kind of had, you know, become like something that I'm going to, like, kind of sculpt myself out of, but I soon realized I didn't have the discipline for it. And also, there's kind of like this family, not lore, but this kind of like family request that my grandmother always wanted a doctor in her family. And then, so my aunt didn't, one of my aunts was supposed to do that, and then she became she got her PhD, but it was in anthropology. I just realized that I just didn't have kind of like the emotional energy to really do this thing that I wanted to do, which is kind of like sculpt myself to become this thing that I wanted to be. So,
take me back on it. What does that mean?
Yeah,
when you're sculpting yourself in college.
So, for example, like you know how kids these days, like, they do these, like, interdisciplinary things, and then they take, like, gap years, and then they do projects, and they're, like, they're, you know, they, what they are is, like, not, like, I mean, you know, like, in the kind of our, you know, maybe, like, job titles and, you know, occupations were very kind of well-defined. You know, like, you're an engineer, or you're a lawyer, or you're a doctor, you know, like, but now it's like, you know, you're an environmental historian, you know, yeah. Like, you know, it's like, wow, okay, you have to explain that to me. So that's what I mean. Like, I mean, like,
you had a sense
I
that you wanted that?
I had a, right, so I had a sense that I kind of wanted, like, I wanted to be, like, maybe somebody who did, like, some sort of, like, international work, who did traveled and, you know, did, you know, whatever, I don't know, like, so I started, like, studying political science, and, but then I just realized that, like, that wasn't going to work.
Why?
Because I think that just because, like, I feel like people who do that are people who might, I don't know, this is like maybe an unfair thing, but it's are people who maybe don't have other things to worry about. Like, they don't have parents who've now gone back to, like, a politically charged country with this loaded history and have, like, there's, like, financial issues and, you know, like, they're not kind of, like, you know, taking, like, the Greyhound bus to and forth to their aunt's house and, you know, like, loading their stuff in, like, you know, kind of like a, you know, a hefty, like, plastic bag. You know what I mean? Like, it's, like, they don't have those things. Like, when you do, you just feel like, I can't, like, so then you just have to do something, like, not easy, but more disciplined and kind of with tracks already in place on this end. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't be like, oh, let me go, like, and explore myself, like, you know, take, like, a, beyond, like, kind of, like, do a volunteer work, kind of on the ship around the world, you know, I don't know. Like, so those, that's what I would have liked to have done, but I didn't. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, fine, you know, I'll just...
What were the tracks that you went
on? Do medicine.
You knew then? That's, that
well,
was...
I just did it, because that's... Because then everybody was like, listen, you always... And it's just like the whole, like, immigrant mentality, right? You always have a job. You need to always have a job wherever you go, right? They were right. It's not that they were wrong. They were correct, right? When everybody else, like, you know, graduate, like, they lose their... Like, you have a job as a doctor. They're correct about that. Mm. You know, and then this, like, you know, this whole thing about, like, you know, the immigrant parents, they kind of sacrifice themselves so their kids can do better, right? And then what's the definition of better, right? It's like being a doctor, right? That's, like, the ultimate, like, you know, doing better. And
was some of this the choice to be a doctor in some ways to please these parents that had then left and returned to Iran? Kind of justifying why you were staying, or what you were, what their time of investment was for you being here?
I think it was part of it was like, I just felt like, you know, my, like my grandmother, she's like, I mean, if we're kind of talking about roots and wings, I mean, she was like roots personified, you know, she'd be kind of like a big, you know, tree with like huge kind of like, you know, roots and trunk and stuff like that. And I just felt like the whole, the way the political events had turned out was like, again, like that wasn't in her script of life, right? Like she would have thought if all her kids would be around her and they wouldn't be like dispersed like diaspora, you know, like throughout the world. And I don't know, maybe I just did it because I wanted to make her happy. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that was the only reason, right? I'm saying it was like easier for me and, you know, like it was kind of, you know, yeah, it had all of those qualities.
I love the idea that becoming a doctor was the easier choice.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
What were your interests in that? You were taking biology classes and taking chemistry classes and all these sort of things in college, right?
Yeah. Right.
With the goal of this is for me to get into med school.
Yeah. I mean, right. So this whole quote, this thing that you raised is that these I paid for that in medical school because I hated medical school.
Really?
Hated it.
But you were on the path.
I mean, I just felt like I can't turn back now.
Why? What was it about medical?
Because I had like taken all these loans, you know, and it was like I can't turn. Like I just, you know, like whatever. I have to come hell or high water. I just have to do this.
Get done with it.
Yeah.
So after UMass Amherst, where did you go?
Tufts.
Oh, so back in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. And family's still there, so you have
yeah.
a sense of community. And,
yeah.
Tell me more about the med school experiences. What was it like being back in Boston after going to college?
You know, I mean, I love Boston. Boston's, you know, beautiful. Like, you can't complain about being in Boston. It was fine. It was like, you know, sometimes it's kind of tough to live with your family when you're in medical school, because essentially in medical school, I don't think people who are not in medical school ever have a sense of what it's like in medical school. Like, you know, you don't understand when I tell you, like, don't talk to me, don't call me, I can't do anything, you know, it's like nothing. Like, I don't think people get that.
Because the work is so hard.
Because the work is so hard and so time consuming, you know, and just kind of like, yeah, exactly. So the part of that was like a little hard, but overall it was good. I did a master's in public health too as part of my degree, so that was kind of like to do the public health part, you know, felt more gratifying to me just in terms of kind of like the work that I was doing.
Is that why you did it?
Yeah, you know, because like even back then I knew that it's I guess like what's the word like just I don't know, like you work for improvement of the world around you, right? And that's what public health does. Like you work to help people around you. And as a doctor, maybe you're helping one person. As public health, it's populations. And so that's why I did it, yeah. Mm.
What kind of medicine were you drawn to in school?
Yeah, so I did this kind of, as part of my public health experience, I did them. I went around with someone who did home visits he would go and visit the homes of families of kids with asthma. And then what we were doing is like we would check to make sure that their carbon monoxide monitor is working, you know, and their smoke detectors are working, you know, and just to look to see like if there are things in the home of this, you know, person who would contribute to asthma and that type of thing. And I totally loved that. Like we would go to warehouses, you know, and I was like, I want to do this. And he said, you know, you can be an occupational medicine doctor. And I was like, what is that? But I couldn't figure out how to do it. Like, there was not a set path. And again, this whole thing about just the inertia of like, you know, these, you know, paths that are not well defined. You know, and I also explored like some other things like the Epidemiology Intelligence Service with CDC, EIS. Epidemiology Intelligence Service.
Did you do some work with them?
With the CDC. I did it with the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. Hmm. Yeah. We did like, you know, it was cool. It was like, you know, like outbreaks of varicella, you know, that type of thing. So I couldn't figure that out. I just didn't have the emotional energy. So I ended up doing family medicine here at Penn. And I was the second year of residency that they had the program.
So after Tufts, when you were looking for the residency, that's when you came to Penn.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you moved to Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
When was that?
It was 2000.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
What was life like in Philly then?
It's different from
Boston.
I always think of, I don't know if I came up with this or somebody else came up with it, and I just kind of like took the metaphor on, I'm not sure. But I always feel like Philly and Boston, like Philly is like, Boston is like Philly's sister, but it's a sister who married well, you know, like they're very similar. You know, there's a lot of history. They're both very kind of like interesting architecture. But, you know, like, Boston's got a lot of old money, you know, and Philly's, like, rate of poverty is, like, super high. So in some sense, it was good. But in some ways, I liked being here because it made it a lot more accessible. You know, like if you're on a resident salary, you know, you can still live somewhere nice and, your rent isn't like sky high, you know, like the way it would be in Boston. Mm.
So coming to Penn and then doing family medicine,
mm-hmm.
what kind of stuff were you involved in then? I mean, was it what you wanted, I guess, is kind of what I'm asking.
So what happened, again, it was kind of like, oh, God, like it was like the same thing back in medical school. I'm doing what I don't want to do, you know. But then I was so just like surprised at how much I liked it, you know. I liked family medicine. I liked that kind of personal relationship. But it was also like this sense of like, I know I'm saying too many likes. I don't know, like the individual outreach meant a lot. I also really kind of bought into the whole idea of, each person's not an island, you know, they're part of, you know, like, so then you can see the kids and the siblings and the parents and, you know, and so that was cool. I really liked that.
When you talk about outreach, what do you mean?
You know, because West Philly is like a very low income neighborhood, you know, and then so, this kind of like providing what I would, you know, because like there is kind of this sense in medicine that somehow money should be able to buy you superior healthcare. That sits so wrong with me, you know, and I feel like, no, you know, you should have quality healthcare practitioners available to anyone of any income. And so to me, like that, I love the fact that I was doing that. And it was like, okay, so Penn is, it's funny because this is, goes back to like this kind of idea, this mentality, this project that we started at Tufts, and oddly enough, somebody just interviewed me about that project too. But this idea that these like kind of hospitals of think of themselves as like these ivory towers when they're located in these low income neighborhoods, and then like, you know, people train and just learn their whole medical education by being in these communities, and they go on to become these like, you know, highly paid doctors, and yet they learned it, you know, from these like low income communities. And so it's like, so that's not okay.
What was the program at Tufts doing around that?
Yeah, so the program at Tufts was we created a free clinic in this very, the Chinese speaking, the New England Medical Center was like in the smack dab in the middle of Chinatown in Boston. And so a lot of the Chinese, you know, speaking, there were immigrants and there were undocumented immigrants. And so they didn't have health insurance. And so like, you know, you have like, you know, top of the line, you know, whatever, the New England Medical Center. And then there's like these people who can't even access like regular, you know, doctor. So then, so we created a free clinic, and then, I wanted to call it Sherwood, like the Sherwood Forest, like you take from quote unquote rich and give to quote unquote poor, even though like I'm not really kind of saying that in Indian kind of connotation. I'm just giving kind of the idea that was, and then, you know, and then my, you know, cohort, like they're like, no, that's like too, you know, that's too polarizing and charged and stuff. And so it was called Sherwood. Anyway, 20 years later or whatever, I mean, I can't believe it's been that long, but whatever, almost 20 years later, it's still in existence. It's kind of like got like developed legs of its own and kind of walked on its own, and it became like a big thing, and now it's like a big, you know, kind of a experience for the students there. And they did a piece on it, and they called me to interview me about that. Yeah. So it was just kind of like, that's why it's like fresh in my mind. Yeah. Anyway, so back to this, that's what I mean.
Was that one of the first times you had done kind of that sort of service outreach, the politically oriented, thinking about different class systems and community work? Was that one of your earlier stages involvement, or had you done that kind of stuff before?
Um, think? You mean in residency?
Well, I mean, I'm thinking
not
more
in residency. In medical school, I had done it. Like I did, my capstone for my public health was having, how would an undocumented immigrant navigate the healthcare system? Like, how would you be able to help them, navigate this really complicated system that even, we can't figure out? Mm-hmm. How would you expect them to figure this out? So that was, one of my projects, that I had done there. So, yeah, so, I mean, maybe it was, the first time that I had done, one-on-one outreach, but that type of work, I'd done some of that before.
The service-oriented work, the part that is about thinking about social responsibility and engaging and giving back and fighting for equity, where do you think that comes from for you?
I don't know, but I would say if there's one kind of fundamental ethos that just drives me is a sense of justice. There must be fairness. And of course, given that almost nothing is fair, you can tell how indignant I am, at any point of the day.
Were you like that as a little girl? I mean, was it the sense of justice that your little sister got the teddy bear? And was it, were those kind of things?
Yeah, maybe I wasn't so much like that towards my little sister. Yeah. I was like, I have all my chocolate and I will have her chocolate. Yeah.
Was it maybe more seen?
No, I was. I mean, yeah, I was. Mm-hmm. It was I don't know. I think I was. It was kind of you have people work in your homes, when you're in Iran, they're not servants. You're just, folks who live with my grandparents and then they work and they helped, make it lunch and that type of thing. Because, food's a big thing there, so preparing it just is a full-time job. So I would wash dishes with them, why wouldn't, if they wash dishes, I wash dishes, mm-hmm. That kind of thing.
That's neat. So after the residency in Penn, that was for how long did that last?
It's 3 years.
3 year residency. Mm-hmm. And then did you stay in Philly or did you go elsewhere?
I went to Chestnut Hill. And then I went to Chestnut Hill and then I worked there. And then I came back to work in a school-based health clinic in West Philly. Hmm. It was a federally qualified healthcare center, and they had just done the architectural plans for it inside a high school, Sayre High School, and they needed a doctor, and so they asked me if I wanted to come back, and be the primary care provider there and kind of started going. And at first we were in a mobile clinic. We were in a van, where, it's on days like this, you're your nurse is I don't even know if I'm having, hot flashes or it's so hot because there's no AC or anything like that. And, people amble down the street and they come up the steps in the mobile van. And it was cool. I liked it. It was very, basic healthcare stuff, but it was nice. And then finally we moved into the space. And
Within Sayre High School?
It's within Sayre High School. They took two of the classrooms, math and something else. And because, the enrollment had dropped down from 1,200 to 700. So there was, not all the rooms were being used. So they, and there was a garden, we had a garden.
A food garden?
Yeah, an urban garden inside the high school, where the kids could work on it. And then the idea was that, they could also volunteer to work at the health center, so then when they graduate, they have certain skills. But we were also the main, primary care facility for the community that's surrounding that, the two zip codes surrounding that. Because And the reason it was could be classified as a federally qualified healthcare center is because they look at kind of the ratio of healthcare providers to, you know, the residents of that those neighborhoods. And so this qualified, there's not a lot of doctors, you know, that are kind of on, you know, that far up in West Philly. Yeah, and that was great, too. I love doing that, too.
The move from Chestnut Hill right out of residency to then this mobile clinic and then eventually into this newly formed health center in this high school, what instigated that move? Why did you leave the position at Chestnut Hill?
Because part of it was that at some point Chestnut Hill was bought by a for-profit company, and I just didn't want to work there.
Was the vibe different?
You know, it was kind of like when I was there, we had a free clinic for pap smears and, you know, mammogram screening. We did a lot of community, like, outreach programs. You know, we looked at kind of like, we were part of like a whole kind of this multi-center initiative looking at preterm labor, you know. And then, like, a lot of that, I just didn't think that I felt like, so maybe that's another way of saying it. Fine, the vibe was different. Hmm.
Did you like the vibe down in the West Philly?
But there was also something else. There was also, I also at that time, I was like, wait, I love primary care. I'm totally bought into the whole, you know, idea, but there's something else I wanted to do. Like, I felt like I could then start to do this whole, like, sculpting my own, you know, I don't know, persona, career, skills, you know. I just felt like I was really missing that, and I maybe kind of had enough time to get past the trauma of medical school and residency and, like, and then think about, you know, so I was like, wait, no, there was something else I really liked. And I, you know, and I also felt that you know, a lot of the kind of, the thing that I love is the environment, and I just don't have time to kind of do that on the side. So I have to make it part of my regular work.
When did the environment become something that was of interest to you?
You know, that's a good question. I can't really tell. Like, I stopped eating meat when I was in college. I think maybe it was just kind of, you know, I don't know. Like, there was, like...
Did you take, like, an environmental studies class? Or was it you went on a hike somewhere and something triggered?
No. I mean, looking back, being in Berkshire is, of course, like, it was, like, such a great place. I'm like, God, why didn't I appreciate this place more? Like, in the summers, you go to the reservoirs and you swim and you just, like, ride your bike everywhere. And you, all the while, you're complaining. There's no clubs around. And, like, it's this place. It's so backward. And then now, I'm like, oh, I wish I could go back there. I don't know. I stopped eating meat. I just felt like, you know, whatever. I didn't necessarily say meat is murder, but it was almost like that. I don't know.
When you think about the environment, what does that mean for you?
Nature, animals, ocean, mountains, desert, kind of open skies. And then, so maybe if you think of claustrophobia, this is the opposite of claustrophobia. Like, think of for me, nature is like the not the antithesis, the antidote to claustrophobia.
How does that fit in with your work? You're living in Philly, and it's a very urban city.
I know. And I lived in Tehran. I lived in, like, all urban. I just feel like I'm just used to, I guess, living in cities. And
do you see the city as a space of the environment? As an environmental place?
No. So it depends. I hate the city in the summer.
Why?
Again, because I feel like it like escalates my sense of claustrophobia. I feel like the buildings are like coming, kind of like crashing down on me. But I think part of it just has to do with like this urban heat island effect. That really bothers me. I feel like it's like, like, it doesn't have to be like that. You know, we could, like for example, I love having the pools, you know, but why are they only open, you know, for 6 weeks? Like, they should be open, like, as long as it's warm out, you know, like May through September. And I know it's all about funding, but then that also bothers me because I feel like those are displaced priorities. And not just because I'm saying, oh, like, why aren't we spending tax dollars so that I can go to a pool? I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that I think that the city doesn't have to be, you know, this, like oven, you know, in the summer. It doesn't have to be that way.
This might be a good point to transition into things that could be, right? What things could be? So maybe we make a transition to thinking about the vision in the future.
Sure.
Do you want to bring me up to speed with any other career work, maybe even more of your environmental work, maybe before we make that leap to the future stuff, you can talk about the work you've done from when you're in that the center in West Philly to the work that you do now.
Sure. So I would say that's about where it all started, like in terms of kind of the official transition, you know, to integrating the environmental work into my regular work. Mm. So I took a class in Lead in Our Environment. Because that was one of the reasons why I liked, because then I felt like I could take classes, you know, back at Penn, mm-hmm. Like maybe audit them. And then I met one of the professors there, taught a class about environmental health, and then he asked me to co-teach it. And then so I started co-teaching that. And at the same time, I was, you know, thinking about I love primary care, but I have to do something different. Like, that's not really what I set out to do. And so then I, while kind of taking classes, and then also at around that same time is when how did I meet her?
Who?
Iris Marie Bloom. You don't know her. No, you wouldn't. You'd know who she was if you knew her. I read this whole thing by Theo Kolborn, who's like the, you know who she is, about...
She was working at the Endocrine Disruptors.
Yes.
Colorado.
Yes, exactly. And about the whole, like, idea of endocrine disruptors and about how, you know, like, if we're trying to get them out, there's this whole process called hydraulic fracturing that's, like, causing these endocrine disruptors to end up in water. And I was like, wait, what? That was, 2009. That's like right when I think Gasland, you know, came out.
Gasland, yeah.
The first one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started kind of, not like in like a very, you know, like it's not like I was like, oh, I'm going to volunteer. I just started doing a lot more work with this organization, Protecting Our Waters, which is like a very, like a definition of a grassroots organization, you know. Whatever, you know, time people spend, it's just their own volunteer time.
The Protecting Our Waters group?
Mm-hmm. Mm. And then I started working with them. And then what happened was that one of the NPR writers, Susan Phillips, was, like, writing these, like, pieces on state impact. And she went out to interview someone who thought that her water had gone bad and all her problems were because of her water having gone bad. And so when they went out there, they're like, well, you know, we know this doctor, you know, who can kind of like, and then that's kind of where all this environmental exposures and how do you evaluate people for environmental exposures, that really kind of started for me. So I was kind of like doing, you know, courses, teaching them, you know, and then doing these things on the side. And then I was like, I really need like kind of a very, you know, like just being like a doctor, you feel like everything has to have a certificate, you know. Like you can't just say you can do it. Like, you have to actually, like, torture yourself, you know, to get some sort of, like, a degree. So I did that. I went back to residency.
To do what? To study?
Occupational and environmental medicine, which is what I do now. So that all kind of like all happened together, and it just like kind of, you know, combined itself to be the work that I do now, which is I work, you know, so I do like my regular job is an occupational medicine doctor.
Where at?
I can't tell you.
Okay.
I'm not allowed. They've specifically told me that I can't do that.
Okay.
Here
in Philadelphia.
You can look me up. But yeah, but then also I'm the board president for Physicians for Social Responsibility, both the Philadelphia and then the next year for the national. And so a lot of kind of, you know, the work that I do has to do with one of these two things, either my regular work or, you know, my kind of affiliation with this organization, PSR.
The Physician for Social Responsibility work, are they looking mostly at environmental context?
Mm-hmm. PSR Philadelphia has two topics: environmental health, mainly, also like fossil fuel, you know, extraction, transportation, energy, climate change, you know, those types of things, as well as prevention of youth violence. Hmm. And then PSR National started with banning the nuclear weapons globally, and then they added environmental health maybe about 20 years ago. Yep. To kind of the cadre of things that they look at. And so they also do a lot of work on climate change now, and then like on, you know, toxics in our environment, like, you know, how everything in our environment effectively, you know, is kind of in the chemicals that are, you know, that are used in our environment, and that type of thing. And
that sounds like pretty amazing work.
Yeah, it's really kind of very, it's gratifying and it's intellectually challenging. Fascinating work.
How has that work changed your relationship with the city, with being in Philadelphia?
That's a really good question. I almost feel like, do you have another hour? it's kind of like this. It's like, So you're an environmental historian, right?
Yeah.
And then Chris Jones is an environmental historian, right? And he writes about energy, and you write about what?
All sorts of different things. Global environmentalism, okay. In particular.
Do you guys feel that you have a voice in the way policies are made in cities that you live in?
No.
Exactly. And yet, the information that you have is pretty key, right? It's pretty fundamental, right? It could be, right? Like, why is that? Why is it that you have kind of this, like, really rich, you know, kind of, like, you know, vessel of information, right? And yet, no one who's in a decision-making power has bother to hear it, reached out to you to hear it, or vice versa. Like, you haven't reached out to tell them how you think what you do can impact policy, right? So that's how I feel also about my work. I feel that, my work, as well as any other professional who in any way is involved in public health, I feel that there is this super important message that has to be this bridge that has to be crossed, right? Where we have to get this message out to how these policies impact us, right? And I would say, you know, let's say, I don't know, like, let's say if you want to get 100% of your message out there, maybe less than 0.01% is getting out there, right? I really believe that events like Flint happen because of that. And so then back to, like, how does this, you know, I feel like Philadelphia could be, could Philadelphia become like a demonstration project, you know, for how you would make that work, right? like kind of not necessarily a role model, right? But you try out, like, what if you could remove these kind of barriers? What if you could empower public health professionals to voice their opinions or to demand a place at the table with policymakers, you know, but to do that, they would have to kind of really feel like they have the skills, they have something to say, and that what they're saying is really important, right? So I think what they have to say is really important. I think what we have to say is really important. And I feel that, well, that's kind of funny. Like, you know, all these kind of like, let's say, industry voices have this big fat cushion, you know, at the table, right? And I don't think what they have to say is like as important as what we have to say. And yet we're shut out and they're there. And why is that? And not necessarily why is that, because I know exactly why that is, but how do we change it? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like, I would say, in terms of the abstract, how I feel, kind of like my work, mm-hmm. you know, in Philadelphia. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, we've got about 15 or so minutes before I think we need to tie things up. So Let's get into the visioning part here. Mm-hmm. And maybe we could start with, the future is how you want to imagine it. We can go with the business as usual and things will continue as they have, or a utopian sort of vision of mm-hmm. all the dreams that we think could happen for renewable energy and greenhouse gas reductions could happen either way. And so if we're going to picture, let's say, 50 years in the future, say from now, that would be the year 2067, what do you think that future for Philadelphia is like? What kind of world, what kind of city is that? How is energy being used here?
I saw that question. I don't know. I don't think you want to hear my answer.
I would love to hear your
answer. I don't know if you would love to hear it. I have a pretty apocalyptic view, you know, of what will happen. I think that just the speed at which people kind of think we can move at is like, oh, you know, like what, like I want to just kind of, you know, live my own, you know, like really privileged, you know, world where I can kind of like, you know, order from Caviar and, you know, take Uber and like end up, you know, at this place and do this and that. I want to have that, right? Oh, and yeah, by the way, it would be nice if we could, you know, like not go above 2 degrees. You know, that those two things are kind of not compatible, right? Or we have people like, you know, Tom Wolf, you know, like as a governor, who kind of really can't seem to be like connecting the dots between, like, do you, like, you can't write a letter to Trump asking him to stay in the Paris climate when the day before you approved pipelines throughout, like, do you realize that those two are absolutely not compatible? And I feel like if we have policymakers like that, it's, you know, this worldview is, my worldview is pretty grim.
So what is the city like that? I mean, if that's what you think the future will be in 50 years, will be more of that pathway, mm-hmm. well, how will Philly be different in 50 years?
I think that, you know, it doesn't feel good to say it. And I guess I would say that maybe I don't even think about it because it's just not really kind of pleasant to think about. I think that if we don't fundamentally change our transition, and if we don't do it like in a way that we a lot faster than kind of we seem to be, you know, doing it now, it's going to be a really hot place. Like, you know, talk about urban heat island effect now. Oh my God, it's going to be unbearable. It'll be filled with mosquitoes because, you know, like, heat holds on to moisture. It'll be this like breeding ground for mosquitoes, right? It'll be hotter, it'll be wetter. It'll be like a lot more, there'll be a lot more poverty, you know, because I mean, the thing that a lot of policymakers don't seem to get is that if you have the choice between jobs that make money, are sustainable, have a future, and don't put the health of the workers at risk, versus jobs that are not sustainable, don't have a future, are really unhealthy, right? Like, why wouldn't you choose option A, right? Yeah. And so I think that, you know, kind of investing in industries that don't really have a future, like, the world's going to change whether we want it or not. You know, like, there'll be a lot more investment in these things. And then, I think that there'd be a lot more poverty. The people who are currently in areas with the highest air pollution, like, you know, where there's, you know, significant higher rates of asthma, let's say, in children than the rest of, you know, the United States or, you know, even the state of Pennsylvania, will be at much higher risk for environmental exposures and pollution. The people whose homes are areas where there's sea level rise, you know, are be a lot more at risk for flooding.
What are you thinking?
Like, you know, I mean, typically we think of Eastwick, you know, as kind of the area where there's a lot more. And then, you know, in terms of, like, air pollution, think of, like, you know, like, again, kind of West Philly, Southwest Philly, you know, around, like, airport, you know, that area around the refinery, let's say, or kind of North Philly and those areas.
Will those areas be, in 50 years, will they, any of those places be dealing with flooding or dealing with these deeper pollutions?
Yes, I think so. I think that if we don't change, you know, fundamentally, like, what we do now, because there's a principle in environmental health that's called cumulative impact. I don't know, and I think of it as, like, for example, let's say, and it has also ties into resiliency. So the more you're exposed to something, it predisposes you to be impacted by something else, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, let's say if you're, and what the example sometimes I use is, like, if you've kind of been sleeping well, eating well, exercising, not stressed out, maybe you can fight off the flu during the flu season. But then if you haven't been sleeping well, if you've had to kind of, like, you know, grab whatever else you can find, you know, on the go, and you're stressed out, you might be a lot more likely to catch it. So your kind of body's resiliency goes down as you're cumulatively impacted by environmental exposures. And so I think that, you know, kind of, we're now, we've entered the age of Anthropocene, so we've really reached, you know, this kind of stage where there's so much pollution in our environment, you know, that you can't just negate it by, eating organic, you know, or whatever. Like, you know, it's in the water, it's in the air, right? And so then, and if you want to, and if you don't do anything to reduce the sources of those pollutions, that's just going to cumulatively build up, you know, over the next 50 years and just make it a lot worse.
Well, let's think then even beyond that to, let's almost 125 years in the future. I like the idea of 2140 as an idea to think about, because Kim Stanley Robinson is a science fiction writer, and he just wrote a book that's imagined this time period. So 123 years from now, the year 2140, what do you think life will be like in Philadelphia? Will we have started making the changes to resist those cumulative impacts and to build our resiliency? And if so...
What's the name of this book?
The Kim Stanley Robinson mm-hmm. book. It's set in New York. It's called New York 2140.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But just as a time period for us to think about Philadelphia.
Sure. I don't think we'll exist then.
You don't think the city will be here?
I don't think so. I think... I'm a kind of a, you know, I also read a lot of cli-fi, you know, like climate fiction.
Yep.
And I actually think that, frighteningly enough, there's many things in Margaret Atwood's trilogy.
Oryx and Craig, the Matt Adam trilogy.
Right, Matt Adam trilogy, where, you know, essentially, like, you know, there's going to be, you know, kind of massive wiping out of, you know, humans. And I don't see us really being able to...
As a species,
you know, but, right, but also kind of like as an area where there's a lot of, you know, there's kind of like a lot of humans living in, concentrated quarters.
Here in Philadelphia.
So I don't know if you want to put that on in your thing.
Yeah, no, these are your visions of the future, and they're fascinating. So Philadelphia will have been abandoned, or have crumbled, or
yeah, it's almost like an agar plate, right? Like with kind of bacteria, right? Like if the bacteria just like reproduce, right? Then they double their population, and then they run out of all the resources that are on the agar plate, and then it all dries up and they all die off, right? It's kind of like that.
So Philly won't be able to pull in resources from the outside to help keep it
sustained? I don't think there will be resources from the outside. I think like I don't think people are realizing is that we are tapping out our resources, you know, and the moment where we double our kind of, you know, numbers to go beyond a number that we no longer can sustain is like minute 59 before the hour's up, right? Where it's too late to kind of, you know, pulling. And besides, like, where would we pull in resources? Like, if we didn't put in the infrastructure to pull in the resources that we should have, like the sun, like the wind, if we didn't do that, there would be nowhere to pull in resources from.
What would things look like if we did pull in those resources, sun and wind and more organic farming, even if it wouldn't solve problems, but it might help alleviate some? Is that a possible future for Philly?
I mean, like, look at it this way, right? Like, they're building this, they excavated this, they tore down Penn Tower, which was kind of like an old hotel on the Penn campus, you know, the hospital campus right across from the hospital. They tore it down, right? And they're kind of building like a whole big, you know, massive other building there, right? To me, but I'm not an engineer, right? I'm not an architect either. However, if I were to imagine like a future where we would have like, you know, a snowball's chance in hell of actually making it, right? That type of construction would really need to have these really kind of rigorous standards that they would have to meet in terms of energy efficiency, right? So, for example, like, let's say they would need to have explored whether geothermal energy would be, you know, something that they'd have to, and they're digging in so deep now, that's when they would be doing it, right? And that when is now, like they're doing this. So then if there was like any type of foresight on the part of like the city, they would be mandating that every building that, you know, is getting constructed would have to explore, you know, these options. I don't see that happening, so I don't really have faith in the fact that that's gonna, you know, that like we're gonna be saved.
So if we're dreaming for a possible hopeful future, is there a potential vision of a future of Philadelphia, 50, 125, even beyond, where perhaps those buildings are being built, and anytime they are digging in, they are tapping into geothermal? So those, I mean, is there a potential for that?
What I'm saying is that like, in order for us to have that future, that thing has to happen now.
And it's not.
And it's not. So, you know, it's unrealistic. Like, it's not as if we can be like, oh, it's not like we don't have the technology. We have the technology. And, you know, it might be that, like, the investments might be higher up front, but the payoff, you know, is definitely there, like, on the back end. And so, but that would mean you'd have to switch your kind of mentality about profiting, right? We're not doing that. We can't do that. And so that's why I have like no faith in this. So then what I'm saying is that, like I went to the Paris Climate, you know, conference and then to come back and then really just kind of realize that this is just kind of an abstract thing for people. And so as much as like it bothers me that, you know, Trump wants to, you know, pull out, you know, whatever, but I feel like we weren't doing anything before then anyway. So it's like all kind of like on paper, you know, what, and you know, so like I don't really, I think that that's just kind of lulling ourselves to sleep to think that, you know, somehow, like, oh, like, if we stay in the Paris Agreement, but then, you know, like, still approve, like, Mariner East Pipeline and the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline and, you know, like, the Constitutional Pipeline and all these things that has been shown by measurements to be worsening, disrupting the climate, you know? You know, so, like, it's, in some ways, I almost feel like, you know what, then I'll just go ahead and kind of, like, you know, get an Uber and, like, eat out all I want. Because maybe, like, it's just not going to be here in my future, so.
Is it even worth trying to imagine what Philadelphia is like 300 years from now? If there are no people, have people resettled it? Or has wildlife taken over? So,
well, it is a little bit like the Margaret Atwood thing, right? You know, it's like where, you know, kind of all the spliced, you know, genetically engineered animals, like they kind of start to have their own kind of ecosystem and, you know, habitat, and then, you know, these like really intelligent pigs and stuff like that.
What do you think? So let's say almost 300 years. Let's just pick the year 2312 as our standpoint. What's Philly like?
I don't know what Philly is, but I feel sometimes a little bit hesitant to talk about kind of my visions of future, because I feel that I want Earth to be there even if we're not. And I think that, especially as a doctor, that's hard for people to hear. So I can tell you what I wish. I just don't know, you know. So I wish that, you know, kind of nature will still be there. Animals and, you know, the ocean, trees, and all the things that we think are beautiful now.
Will those have taken over the city?
Yeah.
I like it. That seems to be a point where we are in about time for us to settle up. So,
okay.
Pune, thank you so much for taking your time today.
You're welcome. Sure.